But okay, if everybody is
Yeah.
all right, we'll get going. So let's give it a pause here. Hi everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the ABCs of Green Politics. I'm your host, John Barry, and we finally reached the letter U for universities after 2 years of this podcast. We will get to the end of the alphabet, hopefully by the end of next year. So today we have three guests who are like me, fellow academic activists, and we're going to be looking at the role, the function of university research, the privileged, unevenly distributed privilege, it has to be said, of academics, and what is our role and responsibility in the context of the planetary crisis and its associated social and other forms of injustices and inequalities. If the planet is on fire, how can we in the academy continue in a business as usual manner, I suppose, is the main purpose of today's discussion. So we have firstly Dr. Laura Horn, who is an associate professor in the Department of Social Sciences and Business at Roskilde University in Denmark, and is an activist with Scientist Rebellion. We have Professor Jenny Stevens joining us, who's currently Dean's Professor of Sustainability Science and Policy at Northeastern University in the States. But next summer, and I hope I'm not breaking any protocol, Jenny, she'll be coming back to the island of Ireland, taking up a position at the University of Maynooth. And then finally, we have Dr. Aaron Thierry, who is a postgraduate researcher in the School of Social Sciences at Cardiff. And amazingly, Aaron is the second person that I know in my entire 35 years in academic doing a second PhD. So we may ask him about that and how that's connected to his own understanding of what university should do in the context of the poly crisis that we now face. So before we get into your own particular journeys and how you came to be a member of what I would call a small minority of us in the profession, maybe pioneers, if we're not being too grandiose, who are wishing for a different paradigm shift in how the universities operate. But before we get there, just given that we're recording this podcast just in the wake of COP28, could I just ask very quickly, each of you, your feelings and reactions to COP28? So perhaps, Laura, could I come to you first and ask you your reaction to what happened in Dubai?
Thanks. Yes. So we were doing an event with students before COP28 started, and it was really difficult for me to muster a sense of, it can still happen. This is important. And I think that's an ambivalence that a lot of people share, going to COP and still taking it seriously, but we must, for all intents and purposes. So that ambivalence just grew and grew and grew. And at the end, I couldn't even face, checking, are they still going on? Are they still going on? And so I didn't even do a post-mortem, so to speak, on COP28 with the students. But what we did is we went out with our climate activist group and did an action against private jets, highlighting the role of Danish businesses taking their private jets, flying over to Dubai. So we flipped this discussion of COP28 into something that is local, and it is something that points towards what our industry in the country that I'm based in does, because we've kind of given up on the COP process, and that is very sad in a way.
Yes, I think Laura, what you have expressed there probably comes close to my own views. But Jenny, what about you?
Well, I mean, I think it was so corporatized, and that was so blatant how many fossil fuel interest lobbyists were there more than ever before in the thousands and thousands. So, in some ways, and then the fact that it's the first time they actually mentioned fossil fuels in the agreement and transitioning away from fossil fuels. So, at least, after 30 years, it's about time. And so I think what it gives us now is, as activists, scholar activists, to push on that. And I think because it was so blatant how little activism advocates were there and how corporatized and financialized the whole thing was, apparently it was the biggest COP2. There were, I don't know how many, 70, 80,000 people there. And a lot of business people mostly there, I think gives us, you know, that opportunity to, it's so obvious how, you know, imbalanced it is, right? So I think there's a lot to learn from it. And I think it's becoming more and more obvious that the companies are going to keep doing whatever they can to continue. And so, you know, but I think it still creates opportunities because it's almost so blatantly, you know, in being manipulated for their interests rather than the interests of everyone.
Yeah, sounds like it's so bad it's good in some ways. You know, that's it. But Aaron, what about your reactions?
I think we're all saying the same kind of thing. But I think for me, the takeaway is, you know, that these conferences are a marker of how far we've come, right? And how well pressure is being applied to decision makers at that level from across civil society to get them to come up with more and more ambitious agreements, right? And you know, I think what it's showing is that we're still not strong enough as a civil society movement. And if we want to have stronger texts coming out of these meetings, if we want to have bolder agreements, we have to be much more bold in and strong in putting pressure at the local, national, and then feeding up from that to the international level. And that comes from growing and strengthening our movements. And I think that's where I always go with these things, is the solution to the climate crisis is not going to come around from agreements at that level. It's going to come from the grassroots levels, which then give permission to bolder and bolder action at more seen, like more from those kind of political levels. Yeah,
I mean, just to finish on that, and it's almost like you're probably familiar with the phrase from Malcolm X, who said, we're not outnumbered, we're out-organized. And there's probably something in that in terms of our discussion and the role of the academy, research, and intellectual endeavor in that context. So if you could just jump into, you know, the discussion, what should the university, what should academics do at this time? Was there a specific moment in your professional or your political or personal life and career where you just kind of had a wake up moment and said, oh my God, the profession I'm in is not doing the right thing? Or was it just there wasn't a thunderclap moment? It was just like a growing recognition of how out of sync perhaps your values were with the job you were in. So I don't know whether, Laura, you want to start? Was there a moment or did this happen gradually for you?
I can't really recall a light bulb moment. I think it was a gradual incremental thing where you keep reading the news and become more and more concerned. And as academics, we have privileged access to the news and the papers, right? So even though I'm not a natural scientist, I'm not a climate scientist, you know, I do have the sort of context to understand what does this mean. And then gradually, as I understood the kind of things that I'm still teaching, and this is changing. I cannot teach global value chains, you know, how they're affected by climate change, and that is just not how it's going to work. And then you start understanding the enormous scale of transformation or collapse that we're facing. And then for me, I could see my colleagues starting to do green research, but it wasn't explaining it. And I could see my colleagues going after the grants and, you know, the career promotions. And it just seemed like it was such a parallel world. And then I saw I have two children. I saw them sort of growing up and thinking, this is not where we want to be going. And this is not the world I want to send them in. And then suddenly these things clicked into place, I think. So it was really a gradual thing, overcoming my own internal barriers. I'm a middle-aged, tired, middle-tier academic, right? There are a lot of reasons, and that's what Aaron and Charlie Gardner and Pauline van Helleman and I have also discussed. There's a lot of reasons why people don't take those steps, and people sort of internally try and set up boundaries because it's painful and it questions your own principles. And that's that's also costly in terms of times and money and the way you assumed your life and your career and your own development would go, right? So it's very gradual.
No, I hear you. And sometimes, and maybe we can get into this, or maybe all of you have had a similar experience to me in being outspoken and an academic activist, that often you're as welcome as a fart in a spacesuit. You get that kind of, oh, rolling of the eyes, or as I now call it, this is me being Jennifer Lawrence out of the film Don't Look Up. That's the position I now inhabit. But I don't know whether, Jenny, for you, was there, because you've been maybe writing about this a lot longer than perhaps all of us on this call here. Or was there a moment that you'd have said, oh, there's something wrong with the profession I'm in?
Yeah, so I think for me, there was a bit of a moment in 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, and it was quite devastating. And I had just started my first faculty job, and seeing this injustices and the disparities in the vulnerabilities, and the, devastation and the lack of adequate response to help people and all of this, made me realize that us as academics who study these kinds of things, we're not really contributing in any way other than, I mean, the hope was how could we prevent this from happening in the future, right? And what work can we do in our teaching and our research? But since then, we just have more and more of these disaster, climate disruptions, disasters, and more precarity and vulnerabilities. And over this time, I think I've seen in my co with colleagues and in academia, it's almost like complacency, like, oh, well, this is just the way it's going, right? So what can we do? We can do more science, we can do more research, we can, but there's this disconnection that is kind of promoted in many of our universities, and really disempowering us to actually get involved and ask the hard questions, like why aren't we all studying fossil fuel phase out and how to accelerate that, because that's the biggest challenge facing society. Yet that hardly any research agendas are focused on fossil fuel phase out. There's a few, but that's not what all the university climate energy centers are focusing on. They're focusing on these technological fixes that actually, kind of reinforce this complacency and like this idea that, oh, well, there'll be some breakthroughs that are somehow going to change what the hurtling down this trajectory that we're on. So I think, I've been in this space of climate energy, thinking about transformation in society. My background actually started more in the sciences, and I gradually got more toward the social science and policy relevant research and teaching and work. Even in that, even making that move, there's still, not enough action and connection with what an empowerment for all of us. So I think I mean, there's so much untapped potential, I guess, is how I like to think of it, or that students are eager for it, right? But then we have all these processes and norms and disciplinary things that we have to overcome. So I'm trying to just have new, different kinds of conversations and encourage us all to be asking, like, why are we doing it this way? Why can't we do, things that are more directly relevant to the biggest needs facing society right now?
Yeah, why can't we, make the world less crap? I mean, that's not a bad place to start. But for Aaron, I don't know whether, your journey to realizing, because you're very active, certainly on social media, and you've been engaged, like Laura, in a lot of Scientist Rebellion actual action. So not just in a way talking or writing about these things, but actually putting yourself out there. And So what brought you to that realization? Was it the research you were doing? Was it something else?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I can echo some of the things that Laura and Jenny were saying. And there was lots of experiences, I think, for me where I did have these moments where, you know, things started connecting and making sense. But I can point you to two that I think just are instructive. One of which was as an undergraduate student, I was studying zoology as a doing focusing on conservation and environmental science. And you know, the lectures were just so depressing, like one after the other. It's like, this is happening, this is happening. And you know, very little in the way of any kind of solutions or any kind of what you can do about it. It's just, we're just teaching you what the facts are. This is the situation as we see it. And when I was pushing back and saying, okay, but you just told us this, what can we actually do about it? It was kind of like, oh, we can't really talk about that. That's too political. You know, there's somehow, you know, it's okay to describe the problem. It's not okay to talk about what we can do about the problem. And that's not our job. And I think that was getting more and more frustrating for me as a student, and just feeling like, well, why are you telling me this then? Like, you know, if there's nothing we can, if you're not going to tell us what to do about it. And then the second thing was, as I was getting a bit more advanced in my studies, I kind of started getting involved in supporting students with the fossil fuel divestment movement on campus. And this was at a university that prided itself on its climate science, right? It was had a big geoscience department, which was many IPCC authors in it. But at the same time, it was also very involved in North Sea oil and gas development. And there were several professors who were getting money directly from fossil fuel companies sponsoring their chairs. And what we found is the students were campaigning to divest and saying we need to act on the climate crisis and science that's being produced by researchers like myself and my colleagues. What we found was that there are other colleagues who were actively lobbying against their efforts, saying, no, if you do that, you're going to jeopardize our fossil fuel funding. We won't be able to continue with our projects. You know, we don't really want to give in to these demands. And so there was this contest. It was a struggle, right? And I think the students did everything right. They went through all the consultations, all of the votes, won them at the student union level, one thing after another, got to the university, and the university said, ah, we're not going to do that. You know, and so what the students did at that point was they occupied the finance department of the university, became a big issue, got into the national press, a lot of attention was brought down on the university, and eventually the university folded. They gave in to the pressure that the students had managed to build. And I kind of really, it was a real eye-opening moment for me, I think, about the way that social change can happen and the role that, you know, power and vested interests play in kind of corrupting public goods. And I think what it showed me was that at that point, the role that social movements and that organizing and that activism can play in bringing about these changes that we need to see. And so at that point, I kind of felt both disgusted with the way that the university had responded. It didn't uphold the values of what I felt the institution had claimed to be about in terms of following evidence, acting for the public good, and so on. And yet, here we saw something of an answer, right? The students and their activism. And so I've taken that, and I've, you know, that's what I've gone and focused on. And I've actually done similar to Jenny, moved my attention from the natural sciences and describing these problems into the social and the political sciences, recognizing that this is a social political problem that we're trying to overcome, and it's there that the answers lie to the challenge that we face.
It's interesting. I think we all share a similar intellectual promiscuity, shall we call it, in terms of interested in natural, social science, engineering, and the need for greater conversations within the university. I suppose for me, it kind of helps being an old Marxist, because I've always been skeptical of the university system as an ideological state apparatus, particularly for my research in terms of a very pro-capitalist, particularly economics, which I think is the my bete noir of the discipline that's probably done most damage to the climate and ecological crisis. But then coupled with that, that issue that Jenny, you picked up on in the last maybe decade or so, because I do a lot of work teaching and research with colleagues in engineering who are not just apolitical, but actively anti-political in some ways, which of course is politics, as I keep telling them. You can't be anti-political. You know, if you're saying you're apolitical, you're in support of the status quo. But coupled with my kind of skepticism about the university's role in reproducing certain norms and values as well as technologies, beginning to see these batshit crazy ideas of carbon capture, of geoengineering, being talked about seriously. I just said, am I in a parallel universe here? Am I the only one who thinks this is absolutely crazy when we actually have low-tech and no-tech solutions? Yes, it may require, you know, changing the way we heat, the way we eat and produce, and maybe we need to challenge economic growth and maybe capitalism, but, you know, hey, you know, why can't we discuss those issues rather than just simply continue with business as usual by using these tech solutions? So it sounds like we're all in a similar kind of space in terms of, you know, being within an institution that we're not fully comfortable with, but actually, that's an issue I want to come on to now. It, you know, that recognition of the unevenly distributed privilege that we do have within the academy, and how best we can, you know, use that. So I don't know whether we'd like to start in terms of how, you know, what do you think is the role of the academic at this current moment in terms of the poly crisis, as we now call it? I don't know, do you want to start, Jenny, and I can move down to Laura and then Aaron?
Sure. So, I mean, I think there's two ways to think about, I mean, more than two ways, but I guess you can think about individuals, right? How can each of us individually leverage our positionality, our position, and our, how we've come to understand this complex situation humanity is now in, and get involved in activism. And then there's also the institutions themselves, right? Because what I think is a challenge is that our institutions try to be apolitical, right? The same thing, John, that you just said about individuals who are trying to be apolitical, is you're actually reinforcing the status quo when you do that, right? And everything is political, and everything is climate policy these days, right? Like, because everything is connected to how we're addressing the injustices and the planetary crisis and all of that. So I think one of the things that I've been thinking about is how our institutions, like the connection between knowledge, wealth, and power. We don't always think of universities within that frame, but that also speaks to the privilege that universities and people in universities, whether students, staff, administrators have. There's this legitimacy and a sense of some authority, right? That comes with what the university does or doesn't do, and what those of us within are working on. And I think it's helpful, or it's been helpful for me at least, to think about the connection with knowledge, wealth, and power, and how the knowledge, like what we teach, what we don't teach, what we study, what we don't study, right? Like all this, you just mentioned, John, the research on solar geoengineering or carbon capture and storage or carbon removal technologies, like all of these things, there's so much money going into them. And then that's where the knowledge, like, focus is going. And there's, you know, students being taught that this is the only approach, or the best approach, or the, you know, what's needed. And it is related to money, because there's corporate interests, right, that don't want the social and political change, and then are pushing the technological changes and funding and influencing the funding structure so that there's more research in the technological change. And so I think, you know, more revealing that, and some of us are doing research on that, right? Like, I'm part of the Climate Social Science Network, which I think some of you may also be part of, and kind of doing research to actually help people see how universities and the kind of things we're doing research on and we're teaching, and how we're engaging is actually part of our social and political systems, right? It's not separate from. And when we see that, I think it does kind of allow us to open up our ideas about how could we restructure or reprioritize and reimagine the universities as places that really have at the core the public good, and for everyone. And then if that was, you know, and I know some universities do say that is their mission, not all, but then, you know, if that really is in this moment in human history, what should the universities be doing, right? Which is actually very different than what most of the tradition and the convention of what we are doing. And universities are so, you know, stuck in this pattern of this is what we did last year. This is how our schedule works. This is how what we do. This is how, you know, so there's so many things that, but there's still such potential, right? And I think that's where there's just, I think a lot we can do sharing our vision of like doing things differently, right? Because that's a piece of social change is you have to have a vision, you have to have imagination, right? Of figure something else. You can't just, we're not actually as stuck as we think we are, right? But we kind of tell ourselves we're stuck. And if you think you're stuck and you can't move and you have to follow the same path, then you do follow that same path, right? But if you, and I find that one of the things I've been recognizing recently is that when there's controversy and anything or differences of opinion, often it is just about what people think what can't change. So if you assume these things can't change, then you go, you know, down this road. But if you open up and you think, actually, we could do this differently, things could be different, then you know, you can imagine totally different things, and there's more, so much more possibilities. So, and but I think so many of us, and even so much of what we're teaching, right, tells students that we're stuck on this particular trajectory that we can't change. And I think it's just, you know, sad and disempowering, and I think we can all and I think that's one of the things we all share here is that, you know, trying to change that complacency and turn it around to action, collective action. Yeah,
that's a good point perhaps to turn to you, Laura, in terms of, you know, what your own thoughts are on some of the big issues. And maybe there's an opportunity for you and Aaron as well to talk about that article that you've co-authored in Frontiers in Sustainability, you know, in terms of that, it's like a paradigm shift. Jenny talked about a vision and imagination. I mean, what are some of the big things that you think need to change, or indeed some of the small things that could have a big difference in terms of the role of the academy in responding to the poly crisis?
Thanks, John. I would agree with so many of the things that Jenny has brought up, in particular this idea of, you know, the individual and the collective action level that we need, and both of it, as well as the inside-outside perspective on the university, as well as the university as a platform for action. I leave the climate psychology angle to Aaron, because that's, you know, where he's the expert. And I will go into the small things. I fully agree we need a vision for the university, and we need to drag the university, which is really a Holocene institution in its current form. That's how it was set up. We need to drag it into the Anthropocene, and we need to make it fit for the Anthropocene, whatever you find of the term, whether you like it or not. But it is something that is, and this is the political scientist in me, institutionally, it was set up in an era that no longer exists, and it's unfit for purpose. That's what it is, right? And that's where we come to the small things, because, you know, I'm a shop steward, I'm a trade unionist at the university, and mind you, a Danish one, right? So we are a publicly funded university in a welfare state. So we also need to look at the conditions and the institutional framework for specific institutional manifestations. You know, it matters whether you are in the Anglo-Saxon system of education and university structures, or in the German, in the French one. You know, there needs to be localized struggle. But so one of the things is that we are, even though we're in a sort of Nordic Danish system, we are so broken down by all the managerial requirements and demands, by the competitiveness, the alienation from our own work, even in those systems that are still fairly sheltered compared to the Anglo-Saxon systems. That people don't have a sense of collective action anymore. Everybody is sort of sitting in their own corner, rocking themselves under the table. Everybody who's sort of looking out at the poly crisis, thinking, okay, things need to change, but where do you see room for agency there? And that's really what we need to change, right? And that's where we need to show those cracks where light can shine in, where we have so many different ways of organizing, of collectively doing things, even, two people as a collective, if you must. And then people will come and say, oh, that's really interesting. I've been wondering what to do. And then before you know it, your group, and whether that's based on research, whether that's based on, again, a trade union structure, whether that's based on teaching. We just had a tiny little group, six, seven people sitting around, and we will push for a climate literacy course at my university. And no idea, will it go well? Will it cost that loss of effort? Yeah, probably. But we can always try, right? And by pushing for it and insisting on it, we show our leadership, look, we will not just do teaching as usual, because business as usual is what basically brought us here. So finding the boundaries and then pushing harder. It's a very small thing, and it's still staying within the institutional, flexibility and adaptability. But it's a start. And then you take it from there, and then you go beyond that boundary, because at some point then the management will push back, because they have their external structures and external pressure points and blah blah. Then you go national. Then you organize at the national trade union level. Then you push whatever institution, learned association you have, right? You will find your academic people, and sometimes you might have to start and sort of reach out to them yourselves. So within the institutional structures that anyone who's within academia is based in, there will always be possibilities, but the problem is it costs a little bit of effort. And that effort has transaction costs, because you can't put them into the next paper. That will surely advance your career, right? Or you will have to get your ass off the sofa and away from Netflix. And I sometimes struggle with that, because Netflix. But it is something that gives you a lot of energy. So pushing the university needs to come from inside. And you might be surprised how much you can do with students, even though not all students are necessarily inherently climate and ecologically minded, right? A lot of students coming through these institutional pressures are also just sort of, no, leave me alone. I just want my diploma, and I just, I can't deal with any of this. I don't have any energy for this. So it's a question of finding the right communities and setting up the right communities. And it's existentially necessary, because without this, we will not have universities the way we want them to be, because the grounds for doing this kind of critical academic work that we need in the poly crisis, like Jenny just outlined, questioning fossil fuels, the conditions for that to exist are being threatened, right? Because academic freedom is being curtailed, funding is being directed towards the tech fixes, or the nice sounding things that are really just greenwashing, because you just add green off or something to it. So the kind of critical academic thinking needs to be defended. And this is my last point before I hand over to Aaron, at the political economy level, and this is the other old Marxist in this talking, universities are a thing of the state. And the state needs funding. And the state, if you take, a medium to long run picture, with the kind of economic growth that we're seeing and the kind of ecological and climate devastation we're facing because of this growth imperative, state finances are not going to be prioritizing university funding much longer. Let's face it. So if we want to have jobs down the line, we're going to have to make sure that our universities are sustainable, and that their funding model are sustainable, and that the broader political and socioeconomic structures that sustain them are also sustainable, right? So on all accounts, universities have to change if they want to still be there 10, 20, 30 years down the line.
It does seem to me, Aaron, that just coming to you now and maybe talk about the psychological aspects, because it's certainly my observation of, let's be honest, people like us who are academics interested in transforming how the university teaches, researches, engages, and uses its privilege, do seem to me to be much more open and willing to talk about the emotional impact of what's happening. Which again is not something we often see in in the academy, where we're supposed to be not only neutral and objective in some sense that I've never quite fully understood, but we're also supposed to be, you know, divorced from the emotional impact of what it is that we're researching or teaching or concerned about. I remember, Aaron, when we met in London back in October, you introduced me to a concept that I hadn't really heard of before, but explains a lot of disavowal. So we're all surrounded by, like, you know, wonderful colleagues for the most part, although we had a lot of scabs in my university on the strike, so I'm not including them in my description here. But we're in institutions of higher learning, of people who are bright and smart. And I look around at meetings and say, why aren't you losing your shit like me? Are you not as scared as me about what's happening in the world? And it's this concept of disavowal that you were talking about, Aaron, that I'm quite interested in terms of how that operates as a psychological defense mechanism. So maybe you want to maybe talk a little bit about that, and maybe also about some of your work and interest in climate anxiety and eco-anxiety more generally.
Yeah, sure. I think this is interesting, and I think it is important, and I think we do see it quite widespread on university campuses, but it's symptomatic of a wider thing in society. I think it's interesting, particularly in universities, because it's where academics are often most aware, right? You've got departments of people who study this for a living, and then how do they make sense of the fact that they have all of this knowledge, this information about the scale of the crisis that we're living in, and continue to function on a day-to-day basis, right? So they've got to go home, they've got to cook dinner, they've got to look after their kids, they've got to make sure that they do all of their chores back at work when it comes to marking exam essays and all the rest of it, right? Like we're all having to enact certain social rules all the time. We've got certain expectations, and we have to enter a process of emotional management in order to just to be able to exist on a day-to-day basis. And so this is where these ideas around disavowal can be quite helpful to try and understand, I think, what's going on. So disavowal is basically the idea that we have a knowledge about something, but we don't necessarily allow it to have any meaning for us directly. So there's different ways that people can respond to information about climate change, right? We kind of often see, you know, the cartoonish kind of climate denial as kind of an example of people reacting really negatively to this emotion. Most people aren't in that kind of state of putting their hands over their ears in that way, but instead they kind of enter, I would say, the state of disavowal, where they feel that there's no moral accountability to them to take action on this issue. So they can be aware of it intellectually, but they don't allow that to then have any direct personal meaning in terms of the things that they have to do beyond the things that they'd have to do in their normal role. And so what that can lead to is a kind of just a sense of business as usual, right? Where people have that knowledge, they can write a paper about it, and then they'll go back and just act as though that doesn't exist in the real world, right? Like in their lived experience. And that's really fascinating to me. But I think it's also key is that, like, why we're so stuck sometimes with this issue, and how do we unlock that and regain that sense of agency that we so desperately need. And I think what it does is, like you were saying, John, is it gives signals all the time to our colleagues that actually, well, perhaps they don't care about this, right? Or perhaps we're maybe it's not so serious after all, because, you know, if the people who know most about it are not doing anything untoward or unusual, maybe it's not that bad. And so it kind of gives a false signal to each other. And so this is the idea about pluralistic ignorance, where we have a false understanding of what other people are actually thinking. And it also manifests, I think, in this other concept by René Lutzmann as the myth of apathy, where we think everybody else are apathetic about this issue, they don't care enough about climate change, when really it's the opposite. They're often so frightened or so concerned that they go into the state of disavowal because they don't know how to actively and positively act on those feelings of concern. So I think the answer to this partly is being more open and frank about talking about how we're feeling, which is sharing our emotions and forming communities, like Laura was saying, where we can start having these conversations overtly on campus, with our peers, but also with our students or with the public more generally. because it's by bringing our own concerns that we can start processing those feelings to the point that we can start feeling able to act on certain things and not being stuck in a state of paralysis. And so in effect, what we have to do is try and break the taboo that what there is sometimes on campuses between staff and between students around the fact that we say, well, we just won't talk about climate change because we don't know what to do about it, or it's too scary, or it makes people uncomfortable. And said, no, we're going to have this awkward, uncomfortable conversation. It's okay. We have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, but let's talk about what we can do. And then one of the reasons that that's important is because it can lead to action. And then, as Laura was saying, action leads to further action and can start to scale, right? And so it's that first step on that 1,000-mile journey, right? And it starts often with a conversation and finding other people who share that concern. And I think the other thing is that it kind of, one of the reasons it's interesting in universities is because it runs into some of these norms, like you were saying, John, about what it is to be a good academic, right? And often academia has inherited this kind of culture of, I think a kind of a false objectivity being associated with neutrality or impartiality. And so it kind of goes back to that key point that you were saying, which is none of us can be neutral about this, right? It doesn't make any sense that concept of neutrality falls apart in the face of the crisis that we're in, because we all have a stake in this, right? We're all being affected by it. Everything that we care about is affected by it. And because we then say, actually, I am concerned about this, I want to take action on this, I want to do to see other people taking action on this, that doesn't undermine the fact that we've made this discovery about the scale of the changes that have to happen in order to respond to the crisis that we're in. It's been coherent, it's been consistent, it's bringing our values and combining it with the evidence that we've gathered. And I think this is the point, is that we all exist with these values and need to be much more frank and explicit about those as researchers. And that's what then can help us have these conversations with wider communities, with our students, about what it is that we do want to protect, what it is that we do want to create. And that's really key to everything that the universities have to be doing going forwards.
I find this really so helpful and fascinating in terms of thinking the emotional aspects of this. And I think something you said, Laura, in terms of the need for, in my view, a mandatory climate and sustainability module that every student, regardless of the degree, they should have some knowledge of the causes, the consequences, the inequalities and injustices, and also some of the solutions and coping mechanisms. But more than that, as an educator, I've felt over the last number of years that I would be derelict in my duty of care to my students if I didn't, at least in part of my teaching, talk about the emotional impact. Now, and I don't know whether what I'm going to suggest that I do and ask your responses to it. I have trigger warnings on the modules I teach, basically upfront kind of preparing students that the issues we're going to discuss on this module are not just academic or historical or somehow just intellectual. They can be deeply emotional. They may affect how you feel about your future prospects and so on. And I don't know whether that's the right way of doing it, having these trigger warnings, because I have had some people say, oh, that's, you know, creating the conditions then for anxiety by foregrounding it. I've decided just to be upfront, and partly because one of the issues that we get, you know, that is our challenges in our heavy teaching and administrative and other research demands, we often don't have the time to, you know, have, say, you know, half the semester's course is going to be at the emotional impact. No, we've got a curriculum to get through, and we, you know, and so there's issues there of the time pressure that we're under. But I'm kind of just interested in each of your experiences, particularly in relation to students and this emotional, mental health, psychological dimension, how you've each navigated or responded to that issue. So perhaps, I don't know, Jenny, if you'd like to, any thoughts on that issue?
Sure. One of the things that I do is try to empower students in my teaching. So, and that's kind of where the action is a one way to deal with grief and difficult psychological, you know, states that we get ourselves into. And so I think that's the way I've approached it mostly like I kind of accept everyone's coming in seeing like and obviously we're learning more and throughout students' time in the university they're understanding more, but some don't know that much, right? And so then it can be a little bit of a shock. But I think what I do is often I do these semester-long team projects, often with partnering organizations outside the university as part of my pedagogy, part of my teaching. So then students are connecting with each other and they're connecting with communities, organizations outside the university on these issues. And then when you feel that you're, you know, collectively confronting and there are steps, there are things we can all do, and, you know, it's not hopeless. And so anyway, that's my approach, is to focus on action and empowering students to know that there are lots more alternatives than you think if you just look at the mainstream media. Like, there's so much happening, so many inspiring people and organizations and collective initiatives of all kinds and new coalitions building all the time, and, you know, and there's a global solidarity there too, right? That we can all tap into. So there's so much in coming together, which is what everybody needs, is that connection anyway. So it's like a way to feel a lot more supported in the face of what's ahead. So that's my approach.
I don't know, Laura, have you any thoughts on this, particularly in relations, like, you know, you're talking about in terms of teaching and this, what I would call a duty of care we have to students?
I think what's become quite clear is that the standard pedagogical models that have been institutionalized at universities all over the world are simply inadequate for the polycrisis. It's too much modeled on that banking idea of propping knowledge in you know, students' heads that can then just be sort of released in an exam situation. And I've tried to train myself in critical pedagogical approaches, and I'm also privileged to be at an institution that also has this project model, right? Getting students to work in groups and to find solutions for actual real life issues rather than kind of theoretical concepts and theoretical constructs. But it's a very steep learning curve, and as an educator, you are stuck between the prerogative of you need to teach them these things because it's in the curriculum and they will be examined on this. And there are many students who need to be examined and, you know, who come from backgrounds where the diploma makes a difference, you know, for the rest of their life trajectory. So you need to also work within the existing structures, otherwise you disadvantage the current students. So juggling this with this objective of making sure that you bring them tools for critical thinking and for seeing the polycrisis for what it is. So there's not just this one green session, but that you mainstream, as it were, sort of the climate and ecological emergency into your teaching, never mind what it is. And that's really costly, you know, in particular, if you're already overworked as a teacher, and then you need to reconfigure your entire back catalog of what you have been teaching before. You can't just go back and change the date on the slides. As you know, that's just what it is. And that costs a lot of time and effort. And you need to learn, you need to find those resources. There's actually a lot of really interesting initiatives out there, like Faculty for a Future, which, John, you know. There's a syllabus bank. Brown University has a really interesting syllabus bank, right? So you don't have to start from scratch to remodel courses and make them interdisciplinary. In terms of not just what we teach, but how we teach, I've faced similar issues. I don't give trigger warnings. I just go full-blown emotional on the students. Most often they don't see that I start sort of tearing up and my voice gets a little quivery because I'm a high-pitched speaker anyway. So, you know, lucky me. But I sometimes stand there and I'm like, how do I say this? I use pictures a lot and I confront them with pictures. Not of, you know, sometimes the starving polar bear, but, you know, this is what cobalt mining in DRC Congo actually looks like, right? This is what mining in northern Sweden looks like. You don't have to go to cobalt to look at extractive industries, right? So whatever is happening is also close by. Taking them for excursions, confronting them with consequences that they in their backyard that they might not have thought about, making them feel uncomfortable. But at the same time, then sort of helping them to not stay in that stage of discomfort and anxiety and grief and sorrow. But at the same time, legitimize those feelings and say, yeah, that's where we are. But then where are ways forward? And those are not only solutions. I find myself using a lot of science fiction in my teaching. That's what we're stuck with. But you know, anything helps. And then all the social movements, like the global tapestry of alternatives, right? All these kind of real existing alternatives and utopias that people in all parts of the world are already trying and enacting and have been doing so for many, many years, that actually show, you know, completely flawed and, you know, possibly won't even work in most cases, alternatives, but why not try them? Why not connect them? So it's a struggle, but again, rethinking the pedagogy behind what it is that you do and sort of teaching them, you know, the kind of bell hooks, teaching them to transgress the business as usual that they're being taught usually, that's an attempt. It doesn't always work because usually you just, you know, often you just do teaching the way they need it, because let's face it, you know, that's also something that every now and again just happens. But rethinking pedagogy for the Anthropocene and for universities in the polycrisis, I think, is a big task that we all have to collectively discuss.
I know, I couldn't agree more. And well, certainly, I think each person has their own different pedagogic way that they practice teaching. Mine is a kind of a form of provocation. I like provoking students, and self-deprecating humor, I think, it works quite well. So you're not coming across as kind of greener than thou, embracing your hypocrisy and saying, listen, we're all complicit in this. There is no, ideal out there. You know, it is messy and complex, and it's one step forward, two steps back, and so on. But I agree with you on the importance of science fiction. I think it is underestimated. Maybe Ursula Le Guin, for anyone listening, definitely a great place to start. I just want to begin to wind up our conversation. I don't want to keep folks too long, and particularly Jenny, to give you an opportunity maybe to talk about your new book, which in a way encompasses almost everything we've discussed here, that's coming out next year. So do you want to maybe talk about your book and any of the themes in that book that we haven't touched upon that you'd like to raise?
Yeah, thanks. So the book will be coming out middle of 2024, the summer or September, and it's called Climate Justice Universities, the tra Reimagining the Transformative Power of Higher Education. And so what I do in the book is have, you know, one kind of critiquing how current universities are reinforcing the status quo, contributing to a lot of the challenges we're facing, but then really trying in each chapter trying to look at what could we be doing totally different? How should we reimagine? And one concept in the teaching and pedagogy is about unlearning, thinking about actually we have to unlearn some things that we think are, like, you know, deeply held, and we already talked about, you know, how economics is taught and these market fundamentalism ideas that is kind of accepted as, like, you know, so there's a whole idea of unlearning. The other big concept is about research. We do so much research on innovation. Everything's innovative. We're always being told to be innovative. But what we really need is also research on exnovation, which is how to stop doing the things that we know are so harmful, yet we, and the assumption is that innovation will be so good that we'll just stop, you know, we'll substitute and we'll stop doing the harmful thing. But what we're finding is that's not the case, right? Like, we keep doing the new things, but then keep doing the old as well. So that's something. And then in terms of engagement, and we haven't talked that much yet about kind of engagement, but one of the ideas is the distribution of universities. Universities are often in cities and kind of in these concentrated places. As communities around all around the world in lots of different regions are experiencing more and more climate disruptions, and there's a need for, like, information and resources and new ways of thinking and doing, and you know, I kind of proposed this idea that what if we rethought the physical geography of universities, and that every community had more like, you know, many communities in some countries have public libraries. What if we thought of our universities more like accessible assets for communities, but also resources that, you know, that could and bring people together, and, you know, not just in the traditional way of what we, and maybe university isn't the right word once you get into that kind of thinking, but the idea that these institutions need to really adapt, and how can we change the way that we even think about who is involved and who has access and who, what kind of knowledge are we promoting, and what kind of knowledge are we excluding? So those are some of the big ideas, and look forward to having lots of conversations with.
University.
With all of you and
the conjoining of the community and the university, and also has a nice communist feel to it as well. Anyway, that's a separate podcast we can maybe talk about. But I just want to ask you all finally, obviously raise issues that we maybe haven't discussed, but particularly, you know, because activism does come at a cost. I mean, as Laura, you were talking about in terms of time, but it's also then your professional standing, career advancement, your sense of yourself as I'm not a real academic because I'm not adhering to these standards of objectivity and so on. I just want to ask you each in terms of, have you found that your activism has enriched your professional sense of yourself and your academic work, or has it been a mixed bag that there has been some downsides as well as positive? So perhaps Aaron, given that you're so prominent on, a bit like Laura, on the front lines there in terms of scientist rebellion. I don't know, has it been on the whole positive, negative, mixed, or depends?
Oh, I think it's very easy to say overall it's been positive. But I think it was an uncomfortable thing to do initially, because it did run up against some quite strong norms and beliefs that I'd been trained in. And it was a process of unlearning, I guess, and letting go of some of those false or misguided beliefs, I think now, around the roles that academics can and should play, which is also ultimately trying to say, stay in your lane, right? Don't do anything that would upset the status quo. And I think, you know, clearly the status quo is leading to this disaster, right? We have to upset the status quo. And that means becoming much more comfortable with stirring things up a bit, right? And becoming agitators. And that means activism quite often, right? So I think there is a huge need for academic activism, whatever that looks like. And I think there's a whole spectrum of things it can be. But what we need to understand is, yeah, like, just doing publications is not enough, right? We need to move into a space where we're also doing public actions around the transition that we need to see. Now, I think we can do that in our research. We can do that in our teaching. And, you know, we were just talking about some ideas there around how we could embed social movement education and helping students actually learn the skills of how we create social change during their education. We can turn universities into living laboratories, as it were, as well. That's a way of trying to do that, and to lead by example, to then inspire action elsewhere. There's lots of things that we can do, but I think it's recognizing that the challenge that we face is one of entrenched power and systems of oppression, and it's only through social movements that we can overcome that, right? And again, this is something that even the IPCC recognize in their reports. They say, you know, we need to see system change, and system change is brought about with, and they say, high confidence by social and lifestyle movements, right? So how do we build those movements? And then what role do academics play in helping build those movements? What role do universities play in helping build those movements? That's the key question that we have to grapple with here. And I think we are seeing people grapple with that question. I mean, Jenny's book is a great place to look, I think, but also, you know, there's a really lovely paper by Uri and Kelly looking at reimagining the university and what that could look like. And I recommend people check that out. So it's called Rethinking Academia in a Time of Climate Crisis. buzzing with huge ideas about what we could do differently, really helping us open up that imaginatory imagine space for the imagination that Jenny was talking about earlier. So I think for me, it's really changed what I think, you know, academic research and universities are for. You know, recognizing the scale and the urgency of the crisis that we're in, it changes, it forces us to rethink what we're doing. And I think, you know, we sum it up in the title of our most recent paper that, you know, there's no research on a dead planet. So why are we pursuing our careers as though this crisis isn't unfolding? It makes no sense. We've got to re-engage with this. We've got to really help people find their agency and a sense of collective agency around responding to the crisis that we're in.
Oh, great response. And Laura, I don't know if you've got similar reflections or something different in terms of the advantages, disadvantages, mixed bag of being an academic activist. Because, you know, let's be honest, there's not that many of us. We are growing, I think, but we're still not the mainstream quite yet within the academy.
I think Aaron just, you know, raised a very important point here, that there's a spectrum of activism, and there's no activism, you know, a competition going around. You don't get a gold star, but what happens is that once you start moving outside of your lane, first you realize that there was a lane in the first place, and then you start sort of exploring your boundaries and thinking about, you know, what you could do and finding your people. And that really is a for some people incremental, for some people it's a very sudden sort of throwing themselves out there. We need to realize that and recognize and acknowledge that not everybody can be an academic activist. Working in academia is also employment, is also a livelihood, and not everybody can jeopardize that by leaving the lane, so to speak, right? So there are also very acute issues of power and capitalism that come with academic activism. Now, someone who is privileged like me in a permanent position, obviously, that I interpret that as also coming with responsibilities and using that role and using that function, and testing those boundaries. And so my activism is maybe on the bit further side out of the spectrum, to the extent that I engage in actions with Scientist Rebellion, a nonviolent direct action group using civil disobedience. And there's more and more and more people joining Scientist Rebellion or engaging together also with, you know, Scientists for Future. There's all sorts of different groups supporting other social movements, but also quite literally putting their bodies out there and standing there again as a sort of middle-aged, tired academic saying, like, yeah, I have deadlines, but I'm choosing to use my Sunday afternoon to protest against this, that, and the other for the following reasons. And, you know, here's an academic text that kind of backs up all the claims that we have, because that's also what we can do, right? We can support other social movements with our epistemic authority and the fact that we do have voices. And, you know, when the associate professor speaks up, that maybe sometimes it shouldn't, but sometimes it counts more than when, you know, the young Extinction Rebellion or young Fridays for Future activists speak up, because those young people, what do they know? So using that power, that very specific form of academic power, at the same time, that can be very ambivalent, because that academic power can be contested by your academic peers. As Aaron said, you know, are you really a scientist if you're political? But that's not scientific. So, you know, I've had colleagues sort of say, can you stop doing that? Because you're harming the reputation of our university. I've had a freedom of information request leveled on me that cost our administration 2 days just to find all my travel receipts and my wage information of the last 5 years. And it's, you know, will I make it a full professor? Probably not, because I'm not publishing as much as I should for that. And that's okay, because it's a decision that I've taken, right? We do need people to make it to full professor. We do need people like Jenny to publish those books that we can then use to go to the institutions and say things could be different. The one positive thing that Adorno ever said in his life, things could be different, right? So we need all hands on deck. We need to capture the entire spectrum of activism And we need to make sure that people do it safely so that they don't jeopardize their own livelihood. They're aware of what they're doing. So, it shouldn't be the early career scholars on the streets. It should be us. It should be the, old folks. It should be the senior folk, because we've had our careers and we've lived through, we've had the academic CO2 emissions. God, the amount of conferences I've been to, right? So let's make sure that we also have internal justice and internal redistribution, if you want, within the university, of sharing our powers and making sure that the right kind of people use their privileges.
No, I hear you, Laura, in terms of senior and secure, economically secure members of the profession. There's a particular onus, I think, on well, people like me, frankly, as well, in terms of how can we use that security and tenure and status and so on to whatever effect we can. But Jenny, let's leave the last word to you in terms of have you found, this academic activist space? Or I think what one of your colleagues at Maynooth, Mary Murphy, calls a pracademic, which is a nice phrase. Have you found it on the whole positive, or has there been some negative aspects to it as well?
Yeah, so for me, I think it's been positive, and at different times in my career, there are different kinds of activism roles that I've been involved in. And so I think that's something that, I mean, we've all said there's no one way to do this, and some people are more constrained than others, and at different times in your lives, we all have different other things going on that we can or can't. And so there's so much variability, and I think the big message for listeners or for all of us is that there's space and opportunity and very positive experiences ahead, because we're engaging on the issues that are so important, and that when we don't, we're just perpetuating this disconnection that we've all acknowledged here. So it I think it's a way to connect with our students, with our peers, with people outside of academic circles as well. And I mean, personally, it just brings, also a resonance, right? As we talked about, like with what we know and how we are and what we're all grappling with, and showing the different ways of approaching it. And that's where we are in this transformative time, that we can't just keep following the same old approaches. So, yeah.
Well, listen, colleagues, thank you so much. I mean, we've only touched the surface. There's so many other things we could talk about. And maybe if I go back and do the ABCs for a second time round, we can go back and look at some of those other issues as well. But I have to say, I think we're going to have more of these conversations, and they are happening. There's no doubt about it. It's not as if we're starting from a blank state. But the reality is that we still got a long way to go. And particularly, it's that sense that I'm sure we all feel is the impatience of the radical against the need to bring people with us as well. I mean, as most of you know, I'm a recovering politician. I was in the molehills of bourgeois power for 7 years as a local municipal councillor. And certainly, one of my lessons, which I've brought into now this area of the paradigm shift, the institutional transformation of our workspaces, because of course that's the issue. These are our workplaces that we're talking about. But one thing I learned as a politician is that if you're one step of the community, that's okay. You can offer some leadership, and but if you're 5 or 10 steps ahead, you've lost people. And I know it's a really delicate judgment and balance between the horizon scanning, what you were saying, Jenny, in terms of the imaginative, the creative possibilities of transforming our workplaces and institutions of higher learning and education. And then also having to bring people who aren't on the same page as us, at least at the moment. There are students in particular, but other colleagues who may not have the same understanding of the science and so on that we're looking at. So can I thank you all for your time, and I wish you all a Merry Christmas. So nollaig chonaid duibh go léir. And let's all hope that the world is in a better state in 2024 than it is at the moment, because the reality is knowledge is power. So let's arm ourselves and our students with knowledge for action. So thank you all so much. I mean, I'm reminded, it just came into my head there in terms of summing up what we need in our conversation here, is the words of the great Irish revolutionary James Connolly: "Our demands most modest are, we only want the earth." So listen, thank you all so much. And we'll see you again down the road on the ABCs of Green Politics. Thanks a lot for listening. Cheers now.
Thanks,
Thanks, Ben.
John.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Thanks
Thank
for
you, Laura,
listening.
for recording that. That's fantastic. So yeah, there's no rush in the new year. If you want to send me the file recording, I'll edit it and put it up, and I'll obviously let you all know. But look, colleagues, that was lovely. I mean,
Yeah. Thank you.
particularly giving up our time, we should maybe not even formally. It's almost like I feel we should have like a climate cafe more often in terms of. And I know, Laura, that's where we first met at a climate kind of cafe online, and so on. Because it's
Yeah.
just so nice. Because I don't know how much each of you have support in your respective institutions. You know, sometimes I feel I've got a bit, and then sometimes it evaporates, and you just kind of feel like you're on your own often. So it is nice to be able to talk to other people who also give a shit.
Thank you, John. Yeah.
Jenny, I'm so looking forward to your book.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you, I'm not sure. I don't know if I follow you on Twitter, if you're on Twitter, but I really
Yeah.
hope you'll just send it into social media so that we can all see it
Yes.
and read it and discuss it.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to meet you both, because I've read your work and I've heard about both of you. So thank you, John, for bringing us together.
Yeah.
Well,
Thanks so much,
hopefully
John.
so,
The
and I'm
first of
sure
many.
we'll connect again.
We
Yes.
will indeed. All right,
Thank
folks.
you.
We'll see you in
Bye.
the
Yeah,
trenches
bye.
on the
Bye.
victory parade. Take care. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks, Laura.